Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Will the slowdown in meat processing lead to permanent changes? That's what we'll be looking at later in the program. But up front, our guest today may have paved a path for finding a better treatment for COVID-19. In 2010, David Fagenbaum was a 25-year-old medical student with the fit body of an athlete, which he had been. But then he came down with symptoms of an illness that couldn't be definitively diagnosed, but it was one that almost led to his death several times. Finally, Fagenbaum was diagnosed with the rare autoimmune disease called Castleman disorder. But Fagenbaum didn't sit back and let doctors treat him in the normal sense. He researched constantly that eventually led to experimenting on himself and apparently finding a treatment for Castleman disorder. Could the same type of research and networking lead to a treatment for COVID-19? Joining us on today's program is now Dr. David Fagenbaum. He's the co-founder and executive director of the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network, an assistant professor of medicine in translational medicine and human genetics at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Fagenbaum, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. That's the number to call. If you would like to send a comment via email, send it to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Fagenbaum, first of all, what is Castleman disorder?
It's a disease where the immune system becomes hyperactivated and then attacks and shuts down your body's vital organs. About 5,000 patients are diagnosed each year in the U.S., so it's rare, but that's about as common as ALS. So there's a lot less awareness for it than many other conditions. Unfortunately, because it's so poorly understood, patients are typically treated with chemotherapy, and that's how I was treated initially when I became so ill during medical school. I actually even had my last rites read to me, but I eventually did research and was able to find a drug that I'm now on and thankfully doing well because of.
Had you ever heard of Castleman disease or, excuse me, disorder when you were a medical student?
I had heard of it in one of my immunology classes, and I vaguely remembered it when the doctor gave me the diagnosis. But even the doctor that was giving me the diagnosis barely knew anything about Castleman disease because it's rare and there's so little awareness. And frankly, even the world's experts didn't know very much about Castleman disease back then.
Are there any similarities or comparisons with COVID-19?
There are. So in Castleman's, I mentioned there's this hyperactivation of the immune system where your immune system becomes hyperactive and then starts to attack your vital organs like your heart, your lungs, your kidneys, your liver, your bone marrow. And actually, this is exactly what we're seeing in COVID-19. You've probably seen and heard the term cytokine storm, and that's the way you describe it when your immune system is out of control. Cytokines are basically the weapons that your immune system uses to fight off infections and also to communicate between cells. And so a cytokine storm is when you start producing too many cytokines, and then more cytokines lead to more cytokines, lead to more cytokines, and all of a sudden your organs begin to fail. And that's exactly what happens in Castleman disease. And it's also the most deadly aspect of COVID-19. Patients are not dying because the virus is killing them. They're dying because their immune system is trying to fight the virus, and in doing so is actually causing organ dysfunction and damage to itself. It's kind of like friendly fire.
So we're going to talk more about that, the similarities and maybe a path for finding a better treatment for COVID-19 a little bit later in our conversation. But take us back to 2010. You are what the kids today would call buffed. I mean, I saw a picture of you when you were a quarterback at Georgetown University, and I mean, you had the build of an athlete, an elite athlete. Describe the symptoms that you first started experiencing.
So I was a third-year medical student, and I had never had any medical problems before. I was training to become an oncologist in memory of my mom, who had died a few years before from cancer. And just out of nowhere, I just had this incredible fatigue where I was so tired. But that's kind of normal for a medical student. And then as the days went on, I had this terrible abdominal pain. I noticed lumps appearing in my neck. I noticed fluid pooling around my ankles. And I knew something was just not right. But I pushed through. I finally took my medical school. It was an exam that I had that week. And I went from my exam down the hall to the emergency department, and they ran a series of tests. And I'll never forget, the doctor came in the room and said, David, your liver, your kidneys, your bone marrow, your heart, and your lungs are shutting down. We have to hospitalize you right away. And so they hospitalized me, and they admitted me to the intensive care unit, where I got more and more ill. I became so sick that my doctors encouraged my family to say their goodbyes, and a priest came in and administered my last rites to me back in November of 2010. Thankfully, right around the time that I had my last rites read to me, we were able to make this diagnosis of Castleman disease, and with the diagnosis, we were able to start me on chemotherapy, which saved my life, but unfortunately, I would go on to have a number of relapses.
Well, okay, let's talk about the doctors and diagnosing. I mean, there are only a few, well, I don't know, I shouldn't say this, but a few that we think of right off the bat, a few illnesses or conditions that would cause multiple organ failure.
Yeah.
So doctors were having a real hard time diagnosing what your problem was. I mean, it took a while, as you just said, before they realized it was Castleman disorder. So talk about that and the difficulty in diagnosing this.
That's exactly right. So when everything starts shutting down, you don't really know what's starting the problem. And so some doctors thought that it might be lymphoma. Others thought that maybe it was sepsis. Maybe I had some really bad infection. Others thought that maybe it was a really severe presentation of an autoimmune disease. And unfortunately, that kind of back and forth of what is it went on and on and on. And Castleman disease actually is kind of like a hybrid of all of those things. It really sits at the intersection of, it's got some features that are cancer-like. It's got other features that are autoimmune disease-like. It's got other features that are kind of like a viral infection like a COVID-19. And so as a result, I guess everyone was, all the doctors were wrong and all the doctors were right, I guess, because they were right that it wasn't one of those things they were thinking about. But they also, but of course they weren't actually figuring out what it actually was.
What's going through your mind at this point as a medical student? I mean, you have some knowledge, more than just a little knowledge of what can go wrong with the body. What's going through your mind? What was your mental makeup like at this time?
So I was terrified. You're exactly right. I think the fact that I was a medical student and I knew I felt deathly ill. I mean, I literally was dying in the ICU, so I knew how I felt. But in the few moments where I was awake, I was conscious for maybe an hour or so a day. And during those moments when I would hear what the lab tests were and how sick I was kind of objectively on paper, I think being a medical student maybe made it even a little bit harder because I knew how sick I was from the numbers. And it was really terrifying.
Now, you said that you saw some improvement. What saved your life was chemotherapy. Since this isn't a cancer, how did chemotherapy work and provide some treatment?
Good question. In Castleman disease, your entire immune system, which is supposed to be protecting you, I mean, you can think about your immune system as almost being like your defense, and it's supposed to be there to help you, but actually in Castleman disease, it can cause a lot of harm when your immune system, instead of being directed to the enemy, starts kind of being directed at your healthy, normal tissue. And so when that happens, typically you figure out, well, what's wrong with the immune system? And then you precisely target the thing that's wrong with it with a drug, and you treat the disease. But if you don't know what's caused the immune system to do what it's doing and to be so hyperactive, if you give multi-agent chemotherapy and you just give drugs that kill any rapidly dividing cell in your body, you will wipe out your entire immune system. I mean, you can think about cancer patients. One of the biggest risks of getting chemotherapy is that it wipes out your whole immune system. Well, for diseases like Castleman disease, we want to wipe out the immune system because the immune system is trying to wipe us out. And so that's actually, that's the intent. So chemo will just completely obliterate the immune system.
I have to admit, I've never heard of chemo being used on anything other than cancer. Is that common?
It's common there are a few really severe hyperinflammatory disorders. Another one's called HLH, Castleman's is certainly a good example. These are diseases where they're life-threatening if not treated, and because there is so many things going wrong with the immune system, it makes it difficult to just precisely target one piece of it. So as I mentioned, rather than the sniper rifle, you basically say, I'm going to drop a nuclear bomb. Mm.
Now, you just mentioned that this wasn't just one episode, that what was at least four times that you were near death? I mean, what happened? You said you started to improve with chemotherapy, but when did the symptoms start returning and how were you treated?
Yeah, so I was initially treated with just a single chemotherapy agent, which helped to basically keep me alive, but unfortunately it didn't really get the disease under control. And then when I relapsed a few weeks later and I was back in the hospital with all of my organs failing, I got a single type of chemotherapy again, and that again saved my life. And then a few weeks later, I was back again in the hospital with all of my organs failing. I was on dialysis and getting daily transfusions. I was really, really sick. And this time, they tried the single chemo, and it didn't work, so they went to multi-agent chemotherapy. They tried seven chemotherapies all at once at basically the maximum tolerated doses. And amazingly, I was so sick before I got the chemo that I actually felt better with every dose of chemotherapy, which, of course, chemotherapy is awful, and it has its terrible side effects. But I was so sick that the side effects were nothing compared to how sick I was, and the drugs actually were starting to help me. I mean, I even think back to the first day that I really was turning the corner. I'd been pretty sick for about almost 5 months at this stage, and it was New Year's Eve of 2010, and my dad and I, we were just so thankful that I was alive and I could walk around, and so we decided to go for a walk around the hematology oncology floor, and we passed by the family waiting area, and there was a gentleman who had clearly been drinking on New Year's Eve. He was kind of swaying in his chair, and on our next lap around the floor, we saw that this guy was on the ground, and so my dad helped him back into his chair, and he looked at my dad and I, and he said, "Thanks so much. Good luck to you and your wife." They're like, "Wife, what's he talking about?" And then I looked at my belly, and because of all the liver and kidney failure, I had a giant protruding belly. And I realized this guy thought that I was my dad's pregnant wife, which you would think would be a low point for me. But actually, I was just so happy to be vertical and to be walking around that we laughed so hard. And I turned to my dad. I said, "Man, you've got an ugly wife."
I actually saw a picture. There was an article that the New York Times wrote about you several years ago, and it had the picture of you at Georgetown as an athlete right next to the protruding belly. And I don't know, I have to agree with you and your dad's assessment on the protruding belly, but I know what that's like. So we're going to talk next about turning a corner, or what you did to turn that corner. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Dr. David Fagenbaum. He's co-founder and executive director of the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network and assistant professor of medicine in translational medicine and human genetics at the University of Pennsylvania. Has quite the story to tell that could provide some lessons for finding a way to better treat COVID-19. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Fagenbaum, you've described your setbacks or the times that you almost died and how you were treated with chemotherapy. Well, now, you know, as a medical student and as someone who it seems as though has a whole lot of curiosity, you decided to not just sit back and let the doctors treat you in the normal sense, like most patients would. You decided to research and try to learn as much as you could about Castleman disease. Where did you start and what did you find?
That's right. So when I relapsed and nearly died for the fourth time, my doctor explained to me that I had run out of options. And he's the world's expert for Castleman disease. And so for the first time, as him being my doctor, I started asking some really targeted questions. Okay, well, I know these drugs haven't worked, but what causes this to happen in the first place? And he said, no one knows. And I said, okay, well, what leads are there out there? Do we have any ideas for what's going on at the cellular level? And he said, no one knows. I said, are there any drugs that are already available out there that maybe we could try that could be effective? And he said, no one knows. And I remember just this feeling of fear and just feeling totally alone, that I was with the world's expert, and the world's expert didn't know because the world didn't know. And so when my doctor left the room, I was still getting my chemotherapy infusions, and I turned to my dad and my sisters and my girlfriend at the time, and I promised them, I said, I'm going to dedicate the rest of my life, however long that may be, to trying to identify treatments and maybe even a cure for this disease. And so it really was motivated by the fact that we had really reached kind of the world's limit. And I think that I previously had this sense that I call it the Santa Claus theory of civilization, and that's that I really believed before this that for all problems out there, that there must be teams of people diligently working to try to figure out solutions, and then they'll deliver your solution, you know, when you need it. But what I learned is that actually for a number of issues, in particular medical issues, there are diseases and problems where no one has any idea about them and no one has any solutions for them, Castleman disease being one of them. And so I decided that I would dedicate my life to trying to understand how does this disease work. And I knew that I couldn't do it alone. I was a medical student at the time, and I knew what I could do is I could start conducting research, and I could also build a network of physicians, researchers, and patients to be able to really understand what's known today, and then to crowdsource from the global network what research should we do tomorrow. And this was a pretty pretty kind of radical concept in research. Research is a pretty methodical, what I call reactive process, where people raise money, they invite researchers to apply, researchers apply for funding. We wanted to do it totally differently, and we have done it totally differently.
Well, you had a stake in this. That may have been your motivation, right?
That's exactly right. I think that, you know, all physicians and researchers go into medicine and research to help patients, and I do believe that nearly all really have the patient's interest as number one. But I do think that when you are the patient yourself, I think there are some aspects of this system that maybe you just kind of accept if you're not the patient, or if you don't have a loved one with the disease. But when you have the disease, I think sometimes that can push you to maybe push the limits, and maybe not always in the best way. I'm sure that I made a lot of people unhappy at times by really pushing too hard. But I think that one of the biggest lessons from my journey, and I learned a lot from nearly dying five times. I wrote a book that came out about 6 months ago called Chase My Cure, because I felt like I needed to share these lessons with the world. And one of the number one lessons from my journey is that you have to advocate for yourself. And if you're a medical researcher, that might mean that you do research. But if you're not a medical researcher, there are many ways you can advocate for yourself. You can push for second opinions. You can ask questions. There are ways that you can chase your cure without having to do research in a lab. It might be that it's chasing your cure is taking your medicine every day, or it might be chasing your cure is exercising every day. There are things that you can do to chase your cure that maybe don't require all of the steps that I had to go through.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned a couple of things there I'd like to follow up on. You detail this in the book that many people were not happy with you, I mean, including some doctors who thought that, I don't know, maybe you were being irresponsible, or that you weren't following like what traditional researchers do. I mean, did you doubt yourself when you had these experts, the world experts on Castleman disease, telling you that, hey, you're not following the right path here?
I did, and I really I really did doubt myself, because, you know, who was I to know? And I had kind of the ultimate consequences if I was wrong, right? You know, I literally was going to die if I was wrong. So I did doubt myself a lot. But I think that for me, the only reason that I was really able to take such a take such a strong stance against the kind of status quo was that I let the status quo do the best it could five times. I relapsed and nearly died five times. So it wasn't like as soon as I got sick, I was like, we're going to revolutionize research. We're going to change this. I sat back and I was the patient for the first basically four times that I got sick. But by the fifth time I got sick, I said, okay, I've kind of given you guys your shot, and not that I can do any better, because I really doubted whether I could do any better. But I felt like I should give it my shot, and that's what I did.
But how did you research? How did you network around the world? I mean, this just wasn't something you did at Penn or in the Philadelphia area or Pennsylvania or the United States. It was worldwide. How did you network? How did you research? I mean, from what I understand, you had all kinds of charts, graphs. Come to people with so much information that they were shocked at how much information you had acquired.
That's right. So I thought about it from two ways. One is that to really push forward the science, you have to have a really good grasp for what's known today. And so I spent a lot of time going through. There were about 2,000 published papers about the disease. And so I went through all of them, and that took a long time. You can't go through 2,000 separate articles in a short period of time. So that was a lot of nights, weekends, evenings, because I was in medical school at the time. So I did that. And in the process of going through what was known, I also emailed the authors of every single one of those papers. And I said, hey, I'm a medical student. I'm trying to build this network. My vision is to connect you guys all virtually online, maybe also in person at some point. But what I really want to do is to get an idea from everyone about what research is most important to do. And so I created this this clear and simple discussion board where physicians and researchers, and then we invited patients as well, began commenting and sharing their ideas for research. And then we went through a pretty stringent crowdsourcing process where we asked everyone, what are the research ideas you think we should do? And then we prioritized them, and then we said, okay, this is our list. Let's go out and recruit the best people in the world to do our studies. And this is very different from the way research is typically done. And there were a lot of people who questioned the approach. But like I said, the disease was actually discovered 60 years before I ever got sick. So there were 60 years of trying it that way. And we hadn't really gotten very far. And so I really felt like it was worth trying a different approach. And thankfully, a number of amazing colleagues in the Castleman disease community really bought into this. And if that initial core had not bought into the approach we were taking, there's no way that we would have been as successful as we've been.
And I want to talk more about your symptoms and experimenting on yourself. I hate to put it that way because that sounds so simple, put it that way. But one thing that you just mentioned, is there any kind of crowdsourcing? Is there any kind of networking going on like you just described with COVID-19 that you're aware of?
So thankfully with COVID-19, I've been so impressed with the mobilization of the medical community. So labs like mine and many others that study related diseases have all shifted our focus towards COVID-19. Even labs that don't even study anything related to the immune system are shifting their focus to COVID-19. So I think that the good news is not only are there a lot of people working on it, there is a lot of coordination and a lot of sharing of information. I think that, well, I guess there's a lot of sharing. The coordination isn't as good as the sharing, and I think there's probably things we can do to improve the coordination for COVID-19. But unlike a rare disease like Castleman disease, where you have to garner interest and you have to connect people, there's a lot of interest already, thankfully, because the world's really counting on this.
Would you call COVID-19 a rare disease? I mean, it's a coronavirus, and there are a lot of coronaviruses. This is just, as it's been referred to, a novel coronavirus, one that's new.
That's right.
Over the last 5 months. So would this be called a rare disease?
The definition in the U.S. for what is to be called a rare disease means there has to be a prevalence of less than 200,000 people, meaning that there have to be less than 200,000 Americans with that disease at any one time for it to be called rare or orphan. And so COVID, of course, early on, fit that definition, but more recently it surpassed that number. I think we're maybe over a million now in the U.S. So it's no longer considered a rare disease, but I would consider it to have many similarities to many orphan diseases like Castleman disease, in the sense that there are no FDA-approved drugs. There isn't years worth of wonderful clinical trial data that we can lean on to make medical decisions. In many ways, we are in a kind of a rare disease sense, and I think that's what you're getting to, is that we have so little that we know about it, that it feels a lot more like we're treating this rare disease where we don't know anything than it is that we're treating a disease that affects over a million Americans.
Yeah, the numbers say it's not rare, but just what you said, it feels that way, and especially since it's so new that it's moved so quickly in the last 5 months. I want to get back to your story. You did something that, again, someone who isn't a medical student or didn't have the background knowledge that you have probably never would have thought of. But you persuaded doctors to remove a piece of lymph node, test it, and save it for future research. First of all, why'd you do that, and what did it show?
Yeah, so when I got sick the fifth time, with each of my relapses, I did not know if I would survive. But with number five, this was the first time that I was a researcher at the time. So I had started conducting research in the months leading up to it, and I built the CDCN. And so I was in a position where if I could collect samples on myself, I could actually run experiments on those samples. And so I did that, and I really encouraged at any moment and any opportunity to either collect blood samples or, as you mentioned, lymph node tissue. The lymph nodes are actually where your immune system goes to communicate with other immune cells. It's like kind of the home base for your immune cells. And so if you have an immune system disorder, you want to look in the lymph nodes and see what the immune cells are doing in the lymph nodes. And it turned out that I thankfully survived that fifth flare. I got the same combination of seven chemotherapy drugs, and it just obliterated my immune system, and it just barely saved my life. And when I got out of the hospital, I knew that it was going to come back again, because it kept coming back over and over again, even after chemo. And I had an important date in my future. My girlfriend at the time, I guess fiance, we had just gotten engaged, and I just everything in me wanted to make it to May 24th, 2014. And I didn't necessarily, have any dreams of living forever or living much longer past May 24th, 2014, but I just wanted to make it to that day. And I knew I wouldn't if I didn't try something radical. And that's when I went back to those lymph node samples, went back to the blood samples I had stored, and performed a series of experiments over the course of several weeks that led me to believe that a particular communication line in the immune system was hyperactivated. It's called the mTOR pathway. And mTOR is really important to a number of cells, but particularly to immune cells. And there's a drug that inhibits it really well. It was approved for kidney transplantation 30 years prior. And so I talked to my doctors about trying to consider this drug. I would be the first patient ever with my disease to receive it. But I was really out of options. It wasn't like there was something else. It was this is it. And so I started taking it, and I was able to make it to my wedding day.
And that was, if I'm pronouncing this correctly, tell me, sirolimus?
Sirolimus. That's right, yep.
So what was sirolimus normally used to treat?
It's normally used in patients who get kidney transplants. So like if someone were to give you a kidney, if you needed a kidney transplant, your immune system would attack that kidney and it would try to reject the kidney and it would consider it to be foreign. But one way to prevent your immune system from attacking the kidney is to give this drug, sirolimus, which actually calms down the immune system. It prevents the immune system from attacking the kidney you just received. And similarly, this drug, we believe in Castleman disease, is working by also calming down and inhibiting the immune system and preventing it from attacking my vital organs.
So this whole journey, and you've touched on this, but is there a path to finding better treatment for COVID-19 using the path that you set out there?
Absolutely. So the basic principle of our work was to build a community, get people working together. Once you get the community together, start performing the most high-impact research to really understand what's going on in this disease And then step three is to look at all of the existing FDA-approved drugs and say, are there any drugs that are approved for something else that could actually help in Castleman disease or could help in COVID-19? So all three of those steps are being taken right now against COVID-19. My lab and our foundation, the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network, have been really focused on steps two and three of that equation. And so we've built a database that's called the Corona database that anyone can access at cdcn.org/corona. And there you can find a listing of every single drug that has been given to humans with COVID-19 all around the world. We have data on over 13,000 patients now, and there's almost 150 different drugs that have been tried in the first 13,000 patients that we have data on. So a lot of drugs are being tried. And so it's, you know, when I went through those three steps, maybe I would add a fourth step, and that's to track when drugs are used. So we're really tracking when drugs are used. But at the same time, we're also using our understanding of the immune system and of cytokine storms to identify new drugs that could be used against COVID-19 based on what we've learned from diseases like Castleman disease, and actually a number of the most promising drugs that can be repurposed, so used in a new way against COVID-19, are actually drugs that were developed for Castleman disease. I share an anecdote in Chasing My Cure about a drug called tocilizumab that was developed by a good friend of mine named Kazu Yoshizaki. Kazu developed it to treat Castleman disease, and he tested it on himself as the first human to ever get the drug. And when I asked Kazu about that, I said, Kazu, I heard that you tested tocilizumab on yourself. You gave it to yourself. He said, no, I didn't give it to myself. The nurse, she gave it to me. Oh, I said, exactly.
That's a little bit of technicality there, I'd say.
Exactly. So, well, so he was the first human, and now it's one of our leading candidates for COVID-19.
One thing, though, I have to say, when you're talking about experimenting on yourself and you talked about your colleague that, okay, the nurse gave it to him, but President Trump has been criticized for promoting several drugs, therapies that possibly could help in the treatment of COVID-19. But he has been criticized, and Dr. Fauci right away has said, wait a minute, we have to research this. We need to know a little bit more. What's different about what you're doing and what the president has been advocating?
Great question. So I am a huge advocate for drug repurposing, which is the process of looking at approved drugs and asking what diseases could they be effective in, and then really systematically studying that. So it might be you give it off-label, like me, how I just got this drug, or it might be you give it through a clinical trial. I think that there are a lot of similarities in the sense that I am really eager, and all of us are so hopeful that these drugs are going to work against COVID-19. What I think is important to do when drugs are used off-label is to track how well they work, how well they don't work. And I think the really important point, I think the thing that Dr. Fauci was trying to get across is that COVID-19 is a very heterogeneous disease, which means that some patients are asymptomatic and some patients are in the ICU and die. So what that means is that if you were to give 100 COVID-19 patients a sugar pill, literally just a spoonful of sugar, you wouldn't expect it to work. But out of those 100 people, about 80% of those people would never be hospitalized. And you could say that a spoonful of sugar prevents hospitalization in 80% of people. And of the 20 people who maybe would need to be hospitalized, a very small number of them would go on to be critically ill and to potentially be at risk of death. So you might even be able to say that 100% of people who got a spoonful of sugar were saved, their lives were saved by the spoonful of sugar. And so I think that the really important point is that you need to have two groups. You have a group of people who do get the drug and a group of people who don't get the drug. And you randomly assign people between those two groups, so that way if the group that gets the drug does better, then you know that it's the drug that actually led to them getting better. It's not because the disease actually, in most people, ends in recovery. And I think that it's important to remember in cancer clinical trials and trials of Castleman disease, no one gets better from pancreatic cancer. So if anyone survived the pancreatic cancer trial, you know it was the drug, because historically no one's ever gotten better without treatment. Whereas in COVID-19, most people do get better without treatment, which means that we have to do trials where we say, okay, you get the drug, you don't get the drug, and the people who get the drug end up doing better than the people who don't get it.
So just so we're clear, you don't advocate people taking medications that they may have heard the president mention or other people mention because there's anecdotal evidence that it has worked.
I think my recommendation is that, I guess the first point is not necessarily a recommendation, but just an acknowledgement that any doctor can prescribe any drug for any reason that they want to. We mentioned at the beginning of the show that 30% of all prescriptions are actually for diseases other than the things that they're approved for. So the doctors are already prescribing drugs that drug is not approved for that use. So doctors can do that, and it's up to the doctor and the patient to make decisions about what's best for their health. In my opinion, when you have a disease like Castleman disease or pancreatic cancer, and no one survives if they don't get treatment, and you learn about a drug where people are surviving, that would make me feel like, okay, based on the fact that no one ever survives and these people are surviving, that I feel pretty good about this data. But in a disease where a lot of people will improve, it may be that it takes longer without a drug, but most people do improve, that makes it really hard to know when these trials don't have what's called a control group, which is people who don't get the drug, how effective it is, which makes me not as enthusiastic when I see a trial that doesn't have a control group, because I know that actually a lot of people with COVID-19 will improve. It could be that drug shortens the time to improvement, which is actually really, really important, and it would be great if we could shorten the time to improvement, but the only way to show that is when you have a trial where there's two different groups. The good news is that there are dozens of trials of hydroxychloroquine that are enrolling patients right now and that will soon be revealing their data. So I think we're right in the cusp of having a much better understanding about these things.
Dr. David Fagenbaum is the author of the book Chasing the Cure. He's also co-founder and executive director of the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network, suffering from Castleman disease. But great story to tell. Dr. Fagenbaum, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. And if my story can help inspire others while we're all chasing after a cure, that'll make me so happy. Thanks so much.
Thank you. For more information on coronavirus, plus a lot of other topics, a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Drawing on reporting from WITF's journalists and public radio stations across the state over the last 2 months, WITF presents When the State Stopped, with a look back at how the pandemic unfolded in the Commonwealth over the past 2.5 months. That's tomorrow at 9 on WITF. Yes, Smart Talk will not be broadcast then, but this documentary, I highly recommend it, of a compilation of all the reporting that has been done over the last 2 months or so here in Pennsylvania and by WITF, so be sure to tune in. The COVID-19 illness has hit meat processing plants hard. Hundreds of workers at these facilities contracted the virus. Some have gotten sick and died. Meat processing plants have been shut down for short periods of time. What it's meant for the meat supply chain and consumers is a shortage of certain kinds of meat across the country, or at least a slowdown in the supply chain, and higher meat prices. Our guest today says it could mean permanent changes in meat processing. Joining us is Dr. Jimmy Chen, an assistant professor of analytics and operations management at Bucknell University. Dr. Chen, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Dr. Chen, describe the impact the COVID-19 pandemic has had on the meat supply chain in this country.
Yeah, so as people know that since mid-March that people have started to hear about the outbreaks from certain plants, specifically is the meat packing plants, that many people got sick. And then government mandate a opening to sustain the stability of the meat product. So, but still, people are worried that the situation will get worse, so that more and more media has been focusing on this development.
Well, part of the reason, as I mentioned, is that because so many people who work in meat processing facilities have gotten sick. This is a labor-intensive industry. In what ways?
Well, so it depends on what kind of product we're looking at. So for the poultry or birds or chicken or turkey, those are the type of product that tends to have standard shape or size. So those products tends to be able to have a highly automated environment. But comparing to the poultry, the hogs and cattle, they tend to come in different sizes and shapes. So the level of automations for those kind of product may not be as good as the poultry. So still, people, the company needs to have the labors to cut and slice and deboning, dismember in a production line. And many times the worker has to stand shoulder to shoulder and very close distance. So the social distancing protocol is very difficult to implement in that kind of environment.
You know, I've always been curious about this, when I say always, over the past 2 months when we've heard about these processing plants. Is there any danger that the meat, the food that we eat, has been contaminated with the COVID-19? I mean, would it survive?
Well, it's hard to say because I don't have the medical background, but from what I can see is that the safety measures, the hygiene standard in the meat processing plant has already been to the standard that people should be should not be worried about that kind of contamination. And plus, once you get the meat at your household, you can just cook them to the certain temperature that should be able to lower the risk. But from what I can see, that shouldn't be a problem.
Well, see, I guess the point I was making, too, is that even though the product, the meat, may be safe, the humans who are working with it aren't. And there is some irony in that. Are these good-paying jobs, by the way?
Oh, no, those are the minimum wages jobs, so ranging from $14 to $16 per hour. And many people, for as much as like on average 40% of the workers in those meat packing plants are immigrants. And those are, relatively speaking, low-skilled jobs, and they need the job to pay the bills. So, and the working condition is not good. There are long working hours and in a very cold environment to keep the meat fresh. And many of them are suffering the repetitive motion stress, like they have muscle pain, joint pain, nerve injuries. So the condition is not good. The coronavirus is just making the situation more visible to the general public.
Yeah, you mentioned, actually, I thought the immigrant population working in these plants was even higher. I know in Lebanon County, for example, there is a chicken plant where it's like over 70% of those who work there are immigrants, mostly Latinos. So when you're talking immigrants, you're talking about mostly Latino immigrants, correct?
Yeah, Central America, South America, and usually you can find people are speaking different language in meatpacking plants.
Mm-hmm. What about the impact on farmers who are raising cattle, hogs, or chickens? What about that supply part of the chain?
Yeah, that's a very good point. So they are on a schedule to send their cattle or hogs to the meat processing plant. So when the bottleneck occurs in the packing plant, they couldn't send those livestock to the plant no more, they could turn to a smaller locally owned slaughterhouse, but the capacity cannot catch up. So to then, because they only have fixed amount of space to have those livestock, they have to do something to unfortunately depopulate their livestock to so that they can have the new cubs coming in and then to maintain the cycles.
Yeah, I you know, and what you say that the how you described depopulate or what that basically means is they have to kill their cattle, their hogs, or their chickens, right?
Yeah, they can hold the livestock a little bit longer than they used to, but to a point, they have to do something.
Yeah. So you have said that, before we get to that, I wanted to say that, you know, another thing that we're talking about with this product, it has a short shelf life. So if there is any kind of disruption, meaning that it has to stay cold for a lot of it to be shipped and to get to the grocery store, how does that shelf life, that short shelf life, impact a shortage of meat or once we have this disruption at processing plants? How does that impact it as well?
Well, the shelf life here, I guess the main point might not be the end product or the cut meat, packaged meat. It's more about the livestock. So right now, I guess the demand surpass the supply. So for whatever product goes to the supermarket, people can buy them. It will be just be sold. So the shelf life here is mostly regarding to the livestock. That's the living animals that haven't been processed. So they are typically they would be raised for several months until they reach their peak values. And that's what I have mentioned about the shelf life here. Because once the animal pass their peak values, and if the farmers cannot still sell them, they have to pay for their feed, for the space, for all the medical supplies. So it's going to be a lot more expense than they can recover. So the shelf life here is about the living livestock.
We have an email from a listener. It says, meat companies disregarded employees' request for social distancing and protective equipment from the very beginning. No surprise COVID-19 went rampant. Had they listened from the beginning, production, of course, would have slowed, but not bottlenecked like this. Does this listener have a point?
Well, I would say that might be the case, but probably not applicable to the entire industry. We do see some companies that have more outbreak than the other companies. But let's face it, the situation is that in a meat packing plant, people have to work side by side. It's very hard to reduce to make sure the distance happens while still keep the capacity going. So they have to reduce, right now, their capacity might be reduced down to 60-70% to be able to have the distance protocol in place. And the other point is about the personal protective gear. But in a chilling environment, when you have all the guards and the face masks, it sometimes will get into your work. It could increase the potential risk of getting hurt. So there are so many factors that we need to consider here.
Dr. Chen, we have less than a minute to go, and I hate to restrict you to that, but you've said that this could lead to permanent changes, more automation, correct? And I only have about 40 seconds.
Yes. So right now the technology is in place. We have the very highly capable robots combining with the X-ray, the machine visions. We could have a chance to transition this industry to a safer environment for the workers.
That could mean loss of jobs, though. Dr. Jimmy Chen, an assistant professor of analytics and operations management at Bucknell University. Dr. Chen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Be sure to tune in tomorrow for the documentary looking back over the past 2.5 months of COVID-19 in Pennsylvania.